Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. The clerk will note the roll. Do we have approval of the minutes for March 1st, 2018?
Oh, absolutely.
Representative Heintzman moves approval of the minutes from March 1st, 2018. Do I have any additions, corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Minutes are adopted. Today we're going to have a presentation from MDH and DHS on federal opioid grants. Mary Kindy, Mark Kindy, and Claire Wilson will be here. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. My name is Claire Wilson. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Mark Kindy, a section manager with the Injury and Violence Prevention Section at the Minnesota Department of Health.
So I am going to start us off by doing an overview of some of the federal grants that have been allocated to Minnesota to address the opioid crisis. And I'm just going to do just a very brief overview of where we are at this moment with the crisis, talk a little bit, very briefly, about our current state efforts, and then talk about how these federal grant dollars tie into those efforts. So what you're seeing in front of you right now is just the trend lines for our opioid-related deaths. And I want to point out that what you're seeing is an increase there of 66% between 2010 and 2016. I also want to point out that between 2015 and 2016, there's about a 9% rise in deaths. Now, that's tragic and horrible. And the national percentage was 22%. So just something to keep in mind, because the allocation of these federal dollars was partially based on the number of opioid overdose deaths that we see in the state. The next slide there, you can see quickly, I'm sure you all have seen this. These are opioid overdose deaths by county in Minnesota. This is from 2016. And then finally, as we're talking about dollars that are targeted to have an impact on this crisis, it is absolutely imperative that we talk about the ways in which different communities have been impacted by the crisis. And in particular, our American Indian community, which is 5 times more likely to die of an overdose death than the white population, and the African American population, which is 2 times more likely to die from an overdose. And so those are fairly sobering statistics, and we'll give you some framework for how some of these dollars are being targeted. Now, it's also worth mentioning that this is part of a much broader and larger effort to continue to strengthen the continuum of care for addiction services in the state of Minnesota, and is also part of multiple state agency and local efforts to combat the opioid crisis. So as you all are well aware, the 2017 legislature authorized a large package of SUD reform services, and that has included bringing certain services into the Medicaid program, including care coordination and peer support services, direct access, and withdrawal management. And I mention that only because some of these federal grant dollars are targeted at leveraging those current efforts, and in some instances, piloting some of those services before they are fully able to capture other financial matches. So that gets us right to where we are in terms of our current federal grants. So the state targeted response to the opioid crisis, or the STR grant dollars, is a 2-year grant cycle of a total of $10.6 million. And then we also currently have dollars from SAMHSA, a 3-year, $6 million grant to bolster our medication-assisted treatment options in the state. And I'm going to go into more in depth about all of those. So the first is our state targeted response to the opioid crisis grant. So again, this is 2 years, $10.6 million. And there were some parameters around how these dollars could be spent. So they needed to be spent to increase our access to treatment, to reduce unmet treatment need, and to reduce opioid overdose related deaths. And all the grants were awarded to states and territories based on a formula for both unmet need for treatment and drug poisoning deaths. There was an extraordinarily aggressive timeline to get these dollars out. So the federal RFO, Someone's on my screen. So the federal RFP was published on, I'm being instant messaged, but I can't see it. I'm sure it's really important. Maybe if staff are watching, they'll see I'm testifying. So the federal RFP was published on December 16th of 2016. Our applications were due by February 17th. So that was a very aggressive timeline. We received 69 different proposals, and 13 were eventually funded. Now, I want to put this into perspective because I get now it's not moving. So, hey, Mark, you're a guy. Fix that. All right. Do you all have the presentation in front of you in paper form? All right. We'll just keep moving. So the state targeted response criteria allowed us to allocate funds to counties, tribes, and community agencies. And so to give you a sense of the scope, 30% of these dollars went to statewide efforts, 20% were targeted to the metro, and 50% of these dollars were targeted to greater Minnesota. Of that, of the full funding formula, 25% are going either to tribal governments or to urban American Indian agencies. Now, again, the dollars might be targeted to those communities in certain instances, but the full community, you know, there's broader impact depending on where those dollars are being spent. So they were both to supplement our ongoing prevention and substance use disorder efforts. They were also aimed at addressing any of the unmet need that we were seeing across the state. So I'll preempt the difficult question, which is how many dollars are enough to address this crisis? And, you know, the answer to that is complicated and difficult to tease out, but I can let you know that in response to this request for proposals, we received over $50 million in requests for funding. So that gives you a sense of the environment out there and the unmet need. So I'm going to turn now just to the outline of where the dollars were spent, the STR grants. And you all should have in your packet a spreadsheet outlining each of the agencies and areas where these dollars were eventually awarded. But I will highlight a few in each area, and, of course, if you have any questions. But I want to give you a sense both the scope of agencies and counties and tribes that are recipients of these dollars, and also just a little taste of how they're being spent. So the first is just over $1.2 million on naloxone distribution. So this went to agencies such as the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation, which is educating and providing rescue kits or opioid rescue kits, and that's statewide. Some of the counties scheduled in their initiative are Beltrami, Stearns, Dakota, Washington, Nobles, Carlton, St. Louis, Crow Wing, Polk, and then neighboring regions. And that's just a slight. They have broad impact. Meridian, which is also statewide, also received funding for naloxone distribution, as did the Rural AIDS Network. Now, iCHIRP, which is Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancies, these were some tribal initiatives that had been ongoing to provide support to women who were experiencing high-risk pregnancies. The Parent-Child Assistance Program, or PCAP, it links mothers to community resources that help them build and sustain their recovery. And those grants went everywhere from Hope House in Itasca County to Wayside to Resource Inc. and then to Wellstone Manor Family Services. So you can see the ways that those projects are outlined through the various agencies, but they include adding work that is currently ongoing for some of our Women in Recovery Service grants. So again, we're really working to leverage some of our existing programming and assure its sustainability. There's also additional funding for peer recovery supports and community health workers, again, to really broaden that scope of people with lived experience who are working in the field and providing supports to people experiencing addiction. The next page, or slide 12, outlines where some of these are going to meet the treatment need. So just over $1.6 million is going to the Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes, or the ECHO program. The majority of these dollars are going to HCMC, which is serving as Minnesota's regional ECHO hub. So alongside other ECHO sites, they are engaging medical communities in a series of learning collaboratives. And these clinics are really designed to help strengthen the infrastructure for opioid treatment programs and opioid office-based treatment programs. Now, some of these dollars, $750,000, are targeted to building up the actual treatment, so direct support to sites implementing treatment, and that includes the Native American Community Clinic here in the metro, and $225,000 to St. Louis County, which is a project that is embedding treatment in an entire continuum of services. They have a very interesting and holistic project ongoing in St. Louis County. And so those dollars, again, are going directly to strengthen the treatment. There are also, again, more dollars targeted towards peer and peer recovery services, and then some targeted for those recently released from incarceration. So you'll see some of those dollars are going to Wayside, which treats women specifically who are exiting corrections and is allowing them to find support in the community. And this really is assuring support during their transition back in the community. And then also funding to the Leech Lake Band of the Ojibwe for some transitional housing and support for people when they're exiting corrections. Slide 13 outlines where some of the dollars are going in terms of both prevention and access. So $135,000 is actually going to help operate Fast Tracker, which is an online tool to help people ascertain where available treatment beds are and to have some real-time update on resources. There's money going to withdrawal management services, which we know are a critical part of the continuum and particularly critical for sustaining people's transition into recovery. We also have some money going to both care coordination as well as to strengthening culturally responsive assessments. So what we currently know as Rule 25 assessments, which is determining level and need for treatment. And finally, there are dollars that are going specifically to prevention efforts, and in this instance to strengthen some of our statewide prevention framework grants, which have been active in the community for over 10 years, and now they are going to be targeted, which have been active for 10 years in terms of targeting substance use disorder, and now we are starting to work on opioid use disorder prevention. So that's working with youth ages 12 through 17. There are also dollars in there for a very specific public information campaign. This is to also will target certain communities, including American Indians and LGBTQ communities, and will be a broad web-based campaign. And then finally, there were some dollars for innovation. Those went to the Native American Community Clinic again to develop a syringe exchange program, a collaborative with our tribal, with some of our tribal programs to think about their own coordination around treatment. And then some dollars to the Minnesota Hospital Association, which is creating a roadmap for neonatal abstinence syndrome. So I just flew through all of those, but you have them in front of you, and I do encourage you to look at them, and I encourage you to think about the areas, particularly in your regions where some of these dollars are targeted, and to be in conversation with the counties, tribes, and providers in your areas who are working on these services. Finally, on slide 14, I just want to speak briefly to the SAMHSA's awarding of Minnesota $6 million as part of a three-year federal grant to expand access to our medical-assisted treatment programs. So as I just outlined in the state targeted response funding, some of those dollars are also going to strengthen office-based opioid treatment and our ECHO hubs. These dollars build on that but are specifically targeted to the American Indian population, the African American population. And on page 15, you will see that there's just a brief outline of how medication-assisted therapy works. We've talked about this in this committee before, so that's just a reminder. And then the grant on page 16, you will see, is used to fund two tribes and one health care provider to expand access to MAT. That is White Earth, Red Lake, and then Fairview, which is working with African-American men. And then, finally, we do know that there will be more dollars targeted to Minnesota specifically for the opioid crisis because of dollars that were released through the continuing resolution at the federal government level. Now, this is simply all we have right now from the federal government is a budget framework. We don't know yet how those dollars will be spent. The appropriating language has not yet been passed. That is scheduled to occur later in March. So while we know that $6 billion has been allocated, we don't yet know the parameters around that money or what the funding formula for Minnesota will be. And with that, I will turn it to my colleague, Mark.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. And we'll, are you going to continue with, let's see, we got
I am
the section proposal.
We
got two questions on the first one. Should we grab those now? And before we move on, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Wilson, for that presentation. While quick, I think it was informative. I wanted to just highlight prevention and the money that's going to prevention. I'm really happy to see that has a large part of the funding attached to it because we know that the cost of treating opioid addiction is so very expensive. Within our system, that prevention, I think, is really important to highlight. And with regard to the dollar amount that's listed here, did I hear you say that this dollar amount includes prevention for multiple different kinds of drug addiction, or is it targeted to opioids?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, so these dollars are targeted to opioid-specific prevention efforts. So right now, both a both public information and awareness campaigns, as well as those school-based strategies. So we have had that similar framework ongoing for substance use disorder. Now we are tailoring it to opioid use specific.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilson, on your slide number 15, talks about the medications that are to be available under the FDA approval process. I won't attempt to try to pronounce them, but you see them there. And I'm just wondering if you are offering each one of those in each one of the grants that's been funded.
Mitchell Wilson.
Representative Dean, Representative Allwright. So these are different medications that can be used in medication-assisted therapies. So depending on the treatment provider and depending on the treatment regimen that they're offering to each individual, it would be dependent on which of these drugs they're utilizing.
So you're saying it depends?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yes, it depends on the person's treatment plan and on which treatment the provider is utilizing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilson, so then my point, though, is that each one of those three is available in each one of the grant programs offered, regardless of what the protocol for each patient is. You have them available in each one of the grant programs.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the medications would be available dependent on the program. So some treatment providers may have all three available. Some may have, you know, a combination, but it's really dependent on what they're prescribing and which population they're serving.
Mr. Chair, so each one of the three, though, is available to be prescribed by the physician in the grant program. Irregardless of whether they use them or not, it is available to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's correct. I mean, these medications are available to be prescribed and are part of the programs that are being funded through these grants.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Can you talk about some of the – do any of the grants go to the source of the problem in either identifying different ways to treat pain and manage pain, or also to stop the rate of prescribing. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. And the formula for the distribution of these funds was, as I said, unmet treatment need, access to treatment, and prevention of opioid-related deaths. So the majority of these dollars are being targeted to access to treatment, prevention. So right now, these particular dollars are not targeted to the efforts to curb prescribing or to think about alternative methods for prescribing pain medication. But those efforts are part of other ongoing state and local efforts, including within our prescribing work group work and the State Opioid Oversight Project. They have specific initiatives to address those issues.
Mr. Chair, can you give me an idea of how much money we have at the state going to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can get you those numbers.
Okay. Can I ask one more question, Mr. Chair? So when you talk about access, you mentioned some figures for rural Minnesota. It was maybe 50 or 60%. It was quite high. And then when I look at that map, too, there's the significant problems in rural Minnesota. I'm interested in a little more background on that. Do we have access through our clinics? Or I know we don't have special, say, centers in outstate Minnesota, and we tend to have some issues with access to health care. So just tell me more about how we are ensuring that rural Minnesota has access to these services.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what you're naming has been one of our critical concerns, which is provider capacity across the state. So these dollars, whether they are addressing the expansion of office-based opioid treatment or the expansion of peer recovery services, are looking at leveraging our care coordination services. These are all pieces of ensuring that providers can expand their capacity to address the full continuum. That is felt much more acutely in greater Minnesota just because there are fewer providers. And then, of course, because of the impact that we're seeing in the treatment communities. So the majority of the, 50%, so half, are targeted to those areas. Now, they're targeted different pieces of the continuum, but they're designed to continue to allow these services to be accessible.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I share Representative Helgerson's concern about the prevention effort. And I think that's really important, but as I understood your presentation, it's primarily focused to 12 to 17-year-olds in a school-based program that's been existing for 10 years. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of give us a big overview. I may be behind the times, but I think the major uses of or misuse of opioids has not necessarily been, in my impression, in those age ranges, and that there's a lot of abuse of young adults and then people of all ages who've gone through medical treatment for pain. And it seems to me putting a lot into one particular strategy when we have a broad range of epidemic issues related to this with other age populations, and is it because there are other resources effectively and as large affecting the adult population, or why is this so targeted at that particular age group and school-based? Because I think a lot of the misuse happens to kids who unfortunately have dropped out of school, maybe because of their chemical dependency, maybe for other reasons.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so let me sort of put that school-age prevention program into a little bit more context. And then I'll also say that some of these dollars are also targeted to a physician awareness campaign as well. So, the bulk of these dollars were not going towards prevention, again, because they were going primarily to unmet treatment need and treatment access. There's no doubt that we need far more dollars targeted to prevention. I'll be the first to advocate for that. In this instance, the strategic framework was an existing prevention framework that the state has been utilizing. So it was leveraging that work. And it's not just school-based. I mean, it works with local communities to work with the school-aged population. And now why that is because even though that may not be the area, and I can stand corrected on some of this because I'm by no means the expert on prevention. But, you know, even though that may not be the area where we're seeing the highest usage, it is certainly where there is a potential, both because of people's unawareness of what to do with prescriptions that are left over or from, you know, prescribing to that age group. So, and also just in general, increasing awareness about the impact of addiction for that age group before they become adults. So those dollars are targeted within that framework simply to leverage an existing model that we had. Again, this was a very quick turnaround on a limited amount of dollars. And then there's also the public awareness campaign. But to say that this is a comprehensive prevention effort, you know, I would not characterize it that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just feel like even if with a fast turnaround, we really have to target resources because we're seeing this as having such a major impact in certain parts of our community. And I'm hoping that you'll look more broadly in the future because I think we need to get to the people who are actually being targeted and impacted by this. And I have not heard in the news reports, and maybe the health speaker who's coming next can tell us, but I have not heard that this is actually a problem within that age group significantly. And in this committee, it's really sad to say, but $2 million for prevention is a huge amount of money. We have not, as a state, invested much in prevention in any area, but for this committee, that is a huge amount. And so we really have to target it to where it's going to make the biggest, fastest impact right now, even if long-term we want to increase awareness amongst all ages, et cetera. So I hope that we'll keep evolving that to target it to where it's needed. And I'm not saying it's not needed there, but I'm just saying it's a growing problem, and I think the adult population needs prevention probably as much or more than this population.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, and obviously this is an important area. My question has to do with accountability, and I had to step out and make a phone call, so maybe I missed it. But, okay, so, like, on these items where we're giving grants, like Mother's Recovery Training, $220,000, you know, Parent-Child Assistance Program, $745,000, Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancies, do we get a report back saying, okay, for $525,000, we treated this many people? And so that we can actually divide it out and see what the cost, if we're getting a cost-effective way as far as spending the money?
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there are federal requirements. There are reporting requirements to each of these.
Thank you, Representative. And, Commissioner, one of the things that we're looking at is, you know, quite a few opioid-related bills coming from members. We heard the first of those, Representative Baker's bill in health policy with dollars attached to that. And one of the things that we were saying is, well, what are we doing right now and where is that money coming from? You know, and we started looking at some of the federal grants that we have here today and say, well, did we appropriate any of those? Some of the questions that we're hearing is, and does the department have legislative oversight, or what was the criteria work with the legislature just in terms of saying, all right, we've got this federal appropriation, we have to, or we're going to choose to send these grants out according to the stipulations that comes with that money. What was the relationship with the legislature and with members or different folks? Just how did that process work?
Mr. Chair, so again, the timeline on this was aggressive. The dollars were distributed to all states and territories based on the formula with those parameters granted, and because the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division of the Department of Human Services is the state agency, is the, you know, state agency to receive those dollars, knowing that we had to get them out the door both through a competitive process and to meet those parameters, one part of that process was to consider services that the legislature had already authorized. So, for instance, the package of services that were involved in the substance use disorder reform of 2017. knowing that the legislature had appropriated funding for those services and had recognized their need to strengthen the continuum of care, some of the dollars were appropriated to those or granted out to those efforts and to expand those efforts. And then, of course, we are constantly considering what our evidence-based practice is. It was, as you all know, the results first work was done prior to the release of these funds. And moving forward, that will continue to be, that will start to be and continue to be a framework for how decisions are made for competitive grants.
And just to kind of look forward, you said that the federal government has within the continuing resolution, appropriated money to the states. We don't know if we're 1/50th of that amount or whatever it will be. Do you have ideas about if that is passed this month or moved this month, when those funds would be evaluated for distribution in our state?
Mr. Chair, I just don't know. You know, we will have to wait to find out both what the formula is and what the deadlines are for allocation.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Kindy with the Minnesota Department of Health, an epidemiologist a long time ago, now a section manager heading up the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Claire, thanks a lot. You really described the public health panorama of opioid overdose, and so you make my job a lot easier. Claire also demonstrated with her slides some of the impact of the funding that's come to the Minnesota Department of Health. So the slides that Claire used at the very outset to describe, to graph the increasing trends come from my colleagues and I at the Minnesota Department of Health. Our mission is to help data sing, to help data be available and accessible to all so that at local levels, other state agency levels, they can have the data timely, accurate, and as easily accessible and translatable as possible. I'll highlight three or four federal funding sources, two state funding, coming back to affirm your work here, and then one other funding source. The Data-Driven Prevention Initiative, we've had just under $825,000 awarded by CDC so far. Unlike the Department of Human Services, the Health Department has to compete feverishly with other states and territories to get any amount coming to the Health Department for prevention. We long for the days where we're like DHS and based on a formula, there's a large amount given to advance prevention. One day we'll get there. But we've had to compete with other states, so at certain times of the year, other states and territories are not our best friends. We're trying to get as much as we can for Minnesota and for Minnesotans. Our three primary goals are to, with the Data-Driven Prevention Initiative, are to improve the use and function of Minnesota's prescription monitoring program. As part of this, we're funding and helping to fund the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy and some of their work, helping their data get more timely and be more available to practitioners across the state. We're implementing community and insurer health system interventions to try to prevent overdose and abuse, and we're working there in partnership with Department of Human Services, focusing on Minnesota's Medicaid population. And third, we're evaluating state-level practices and policies, representative of your question on accountability, trying to make sure that what we're doing is best and implemented in the best way possible. The second major funding stream is for just under $385,000 so far. We have another year and a half of that funding coming, and that's to strengthen our surveillance, our understanding the data that we do have, and really in three areas. One, we want to make sure that unintentional or the non-fatal overdoses are captured. Second, that we understand all deaths related to overdose and that we're finding and accurately understanding what's happening with the fatal overdoses. And third, that we're being able to translate that data and share it with stakeholders, again, from other state agencies to local partners, law enforcement, et cetera. Claire mentioned and described the state targeted response funding. We are one of Department of Human Services grantees, and that's in particular with our relationship with funding emergency medical services programs across Minnesota. $300,000 came from the state targeted response funding from DHS through MDH and directly out to our EMS programs. That's specifically to provide naloxone, to provide training so that our first responders know how to use it and are comfortable with using that that intervention. Lastly, we have one-time funding from the Office of Women's Health, and that's for the Health Department to develop a model for practitioners to improve how they screen girls and young women, specifically for preventing opioid abuse and focusing on American Indians, our LGBT plus communities, and African American communities. So that's a one-time, highly competitive grant. My colleagues in our Office of Maternal and Child Health were successful in getting that funding, and we're really excited about what we're able to learn with that funding. On the back page of the handout, two funding streams. One's finished. This body, 2 years ago in 2015, appropriated $290,000 to test and see what could be done with equipping first responders with naloxone. The Health Department put $250,000 of that, $40,000 allocated to the Department for administrative support and for getting the grants out. $250,000 went directly into our first responders to purchase naloxone, conduct training. That served as the platform for, since the grants were already in place, for Department of Human Services to be able to fund the $300,000 from the state targeted response. And then last year, this very body appropriated just over $1 million to test pilot prevention projects for opioid overdose prevention at the community level. And we're excited to say that we started acting on that immediately. $300,000 has been awarded as a technical contract to St. Gabriel's Hospital in Little Falls for them to advise the department and other state agencies in how to do prevention at the community level. The other $700,000 is going to be awarded. Actually, we're meeting on Thursday to evaluate 19 applications that were received. We only have funding to award 7 to 10, but we hope to have those grant contracts in place by the end of March. And they'll last for 2 years, and we hope to learn in partnership with St. Gabriel's and be able to report back to you what's working in prevention. So thank you to you for awarding dollars to prevention from our state general fund, and we're excited to assess the impact. You also gave permission last year for our state health improvement partnership to work to have permission to move into the opioid prevention epidemic. And there's no funding attached at this juncture, but we have several SHIP grantees who are excited about making a difference and working with healthcare partners and other state and local agencies to try to make a difference in their local areas. And we're really pleased to report their willingness, even though they don't have specific funding as of yet. Lastly, in the Minnesota Department of Health, we have a health informatics group, and their work has been not opioid specific, but their current state and federal dollars are for broader e-health and informatics activities that will certainly strengthen how information is shared, and that will affect and influence the opioid prevention work as well. We did receive permission to apply for not a federal funding source, not a state funding source, but it's from the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, a one-time $50,000 grant to help us test a pilot drug overdose system. We're working with four hospitals, specifically St. Luke's and St. Mary's and Duluth, Regions, and Hennepin County Medical Center here in the Twin Cities. So that's an overview of the state, federal, and other funding sources to and through the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm eager to answer any other questions he may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kindy. Any questions for Mr. Kindy from the members? One of the questions, one of the things that we have had is several of these grants are, as you point out, to tribal entities and trying to address some of the great disparities that we hear in the reporting. And that the numbers are really stark on that, that we've heard five times. This seems like a number that's kind of unfathomable. Some of the other reporting that we have on for pregnant moms with other kids, how to best get care for pregnant mothers who have other children, you know, the difficulty of going into a residential environment when you have kids and how the best way to handle that is. And some of those numbers are just unbelievably high, like so many of the numbers that we hear with opioids. You see the numbers and you almost, you don't think they're real because they're so high. Mm-hmm. Do we, what kind of reporting do we have around maternal, either self-identification or identification through through the hospitals with people to, is that mandatory reporting? And then do we have that by county, by demographic, by tribe? How do we keep track of that? So I can look at this and I can know that that's from the Department of Health. It's not anecdotal. It's real. Talk a little bit about how we keep track of that.
Sure. Well, thankfully, one of my great colleagues here on the maternal issues is here in the audience. And if you'd like Susan Castellanos to come to the table, she can speak to that part. I can speak more broadly to the data and how we collect it, but for maternal collection and analysis, my colleague Susan is outstanding. So
Maybe if you could just talk just generally, and then if she sure. would like to just interject a little bit on maternal numbers and maybe some of the treatment ideas, that would be great.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the we're more confident about our race and ethnicity on our death data. Our Minnesota's death data are robust and are among the best in the nation. Our how we go about capturing race and ethnicity is vetted, validated. Our Office of Vital Records is again among the strongest in the nation, and so my team and I end up being users of our death data in terms of our analysis and how we depend on that. There are times where we do have programs where we collect the same data from other reporting sources. So, for example, we'll get death data from medical examiners and coroners as well as from our Office of Vital Records. And so we do some of those internal comparisons to validate and make sure that our death data are certainly as strong as they can be. Our hospital data, our non-fatal data, our 2016 was our first year for our hospital association to capture race and ethnicity and language data. And so our team is going to abstract a sample of those cases so that we can speak to how valid and reliable they are. I think our colleagues at the hospital association have encouraged us to do that, want to partner with us in our reabstraction of the sample so that we can speak to how accurate the non-fatal data are. But right now, I'd say we probably have a wider confidence interval on the non-fatal data in terms of race and ethnicity. However, our death data are you can take to the proverbial bank.
Thank you. Ms. Castellano would like to come down. Great. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Castellano. Please introduce yourself for the record. And then if you just want to just speak generally about maternal numbers and just kind of how we're tracking that around the state.
Sure.
And how we might be, look, how that might line up with some of these grants.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Castellano, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. And with regard to birth or pregnant women specifically, we actually work with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services to look at Medicaid data. That's our best source of that data, looking for that coding that NAS was discovered. Now, of course, if it wasn't discovered, it wasn't coded. And so sometimes infants aren't identified with NAS right away in the hospital. It only presents 3 to 5 days later. But we do see those numbers going up, and we see about 1.5% of all Medicaid-covered births, that's back to 2014 now, showing up with that diagnosis code attached to it, and I'd say that's underreporting, if anything. That rate is 9.8 for American Indian infants in the Medicaid program, so it's much higher than it is for the overall rate.
Could you give those two numbers again, please?
Sure. For 2014, it was 1.5 in, for all Medicaid-covered births, and in that same year, it was 9.8% for folks identified as American Indian in that data.
Almost 10 times?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. Questions? All right. Seeing none. Thank you so much, Mr. Kennedy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Commissioner Wilson, anything else?
No, thank you.
You're good? Thank you. Thanks for coming in today. We do appreciate it. All right, now we are going to have a discussion on interagency agreements, and we have Brian Austin, Dave Greenman, and Alex Kutzoff. Welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself and proceed in whatever order you would prefer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director at the Department of Human Services.
Brian Austin, Budget Director, Minnesota Department of Health.
I'm Alex Kutz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Human Services.
Maybe I'll go first and just kind of give a little bit of background on interagency agreements, if that's okay, and then we can sort of open it up to questions afterwards. State law requires the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health to submit quarterly reports of our interagency of any interagency agreement to which we're greater than $100,000 to which we're a party. In your packets is listed. In your packets is the list that the Department of Human Services submitted with the second quarter of fiscal year 2018. And I believe you have a packet as well from the Department of Health with our interagency agreements. I believe for DHS, the total number is of 56 interagency agreements. Ms. Iverson has a copy or has electronic versions of our interagency agreements in case members are wanting to take a look at those. In total, DHS is party to approximately 100 interagency agreements, including those that are worth less than $100,000. So that's the total, sort of the total for DHS. The authority for agencies to enter into, the general authority for agencies to enter into interagency agreements is in section 471.59 of the statutes. And what that basically does is that says that an agency, we'll call it the requesting agency, has the authority to contract with a responding agency for the purposes of having the responding agency provide services to the requesting agency that the responding agency is authorized to provide. The department enters into interagency agreements for a variety of reasons, one being to request services from another agency, to meet department requirement to be our fulfill our requirements that we're not that the other agency may be better suited to meet or to perform those services. Also, to provide services for another agency if we have resources or expertise that another agency may not possess. We also enter into interagency agreements for the purposes of collaborating with other agencies. One big reason why we do interagency agreements is to draw down federal funds. As you know, DHS is the Medicaid, the state agency for Medicaid, and also the cognizant agency for TANF. But often other agencies perform services that qualify for these federal funds, like TANF or Medicaid. And we enter into these interagency agreements so that those other agencies can get access to the federal dollars. And finally, we enter into interagency agreements for the purposes of, or because the legislature has directed us to do so. We have, for DHS at least, most of our interagency agreements, 26, are with MMB, followed by the Department of Health with 19. Corrections, we have 7. With DEED, we have 6. And then with the courts and with the Department of Education, we have 5 each. With 58 interagency agreements, we can't really go through all of them, but I thought I would just sort of summarize a few of them as sort of background information. Number 17 in your DHS list is an agreement that we have with the Department of Health for child and teen checkup training. We require providers who provide child and teen checkup services that are covered by MA to meet federal requirements in terms of training. And we rely on, through this agreement, we rely on the public health and the early childhood expertise of the health department to provide the training. And then the federal government ends up, we pass through the federal MA match to the health department so that they get those dollars to help defray the cost of that service. We also have a number of interagency agreements with the Department of Corrections to provide laundry services for our state facilities like the Anoka Regional Treatment Center and St. Peter. We pay the corrections department to do that work for us. Another example is number 19 in your list, which is teen parent home visiting. The legislature appropriates TANF money directly to the Department of Health to do family home visiting, but because DHS is the cognizant agency for TANF funds, the dollars have to flow through us. And so we, at the direction of the legislature, enter into interagency agreements for the purposes of getting those dollars to the health department. So those are some of the examples of some of the interagency agreements we have. I think in general we find them to be a helpful way to be more efficient in the use of state resources, and it's a way to solve problems more quickly than going through a procurement process might be. So we're happy to answer any questions you might have. Or Brian, I don't know if you have more to add.
I don't want to restate anything that you've already stated. I'll just say that many of the agreements that we have, active agreements in state fiscal 2018, relate to our laboratory and public health expertise, where the Minnesota Department of Health is tapped to provide some services. We have 32 agreements that met the reporting threshold this fiscal year. Many of those emanate from federal sources of funding. Of our 32 reportable agreements, 19 of them are with DHS, and that accounts for the vast majority of our dollars as well. Over 90% of the total value of all of our interagency agreements are with DHS. We have a lot of interagency coordination around those efforts. We only have about 7 agreements that fall below the $100,000 reporting threshold this year, and most of those are for analyzing laboratory samples in our public health laboratory. So the universe you're seeing here, the reportable agreements, covers most of the work that's being done through interagency agreements that's performed by the Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. Ms. Cutler? Okay. Well, one of the things that I think it obviously makes a lot of sense for the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to enter into interagency agreements for lots of different reasons, but primarily it makes sense just from a common sense standpoint, from just use of personnel resources to do projects, because health does a lot of projects, DHS has a lot of people, it makes a lot of sense to not have to hire people and move people around, that makes a lot of sense. And expertise, areas of expertise, if you can rely on one agency to another, it just makes a lot of sense. When what I've noticed over the, you know, the years has been an increasing amount in the dollar amount and the scope of the interagency agreements, where it can be a way of redrawing a legislative approval, so that, let's say, an agency wants to do something, the legislature doesn't tell them to do it or allow them to do it, one agency can ask another agency to enter into an agreement to do that, or for an appropriation, if an appropriation is not given, that one agency can simply bill another agency and kind of move the contours of their budget in such a way that you can move things around a little bit. That's why I've been trying to push for the reporting requirements and actually legislative approval of interagency agreements over a certain size to reassert the authority of the legislature when that pushes its boundaries from common sense, working together, efficiency, to redrawing of a legislative budget or an executive budget. And so that's been a tension that's kind of crept up more and more. Could you talk about that, Mr. Greenman, just in terms of how you see that from your branch of the tree, of how you balance that out and what the reporting requirements are currently, and are they onerous, or are they, do they make sense from your standpoint?
Mr. Chair, I guess a couple comments. I think one of the things I would say, just in thinking about what you're saying, is some of the largest interagency agreements we have right now are regarding the federal dollars that we've got. For example, we've got one, the $17 million for TANF home visiting that just goes through the feds. We've got one for $21 million that involves expedited court hearings related to child support, and that brings in Title IV-D dollars to the courts to cover their costs. And so we do have, the value of, there are some pretty expensive interagency agreements in here, I agree, and it's worth, definitely, I think it's good that we're reporting on them, because I think it's important to have that legislative oversight involved. I'm not aware, and I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of any time when we've been told, and maybe you can tell me where I'm misled on this, maybe, but where we've been told no about something and then and went around and did an interagency agreement. I'm not familiar exactly when that would be, but.
Well, I think just with the scale of some of the agreements and how they've kind of crept up, particularly with headcount on specific projects.
Okay.
That is something that we have just kind of noticed. It's like, oh, well, that was handled within an interagency agreement. We would say, well, where's your statutory authority to spend that money? And then the response back is within an interagency agreement within this project. Those are some of the committee requests that we've had. Then the correspondence that we've had is, where's your statutory authority? And it's within an interagency agreement. Those have kind of gone back and forth. So that's a little bit of the history of that. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question to the testifiers, if you can refresh my memory, on line 27, it's a state innovation model grant for around $25 million. What does that entail?
That's federal funding that DHS, I think, is a direct recipient from the Health Services and Resources Administration, or Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA. I don't know if
that's
one.
Correct. It's an ongoing grant, or I think it just is recently, it's wrapping up now, but it was a multi-year grant that DHS and the Health Department collaboratively entered into to look at designing and implementing different ways of delivering health care services in the state.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Greenman and the other testifiers. I, of course, am also the recipient of all of these reports, these quarterly reports about all these interagency agreements. And, I'm overwhelmed by them. I can't read them. I would rather not be receiving them, frankly. But my question to you is, what is the cost? Is there a cost to preparing all this to email to me every quarter? Or is this something you'd just be assembling tables like this anyway? I mean, you're not just sending us this table. You're sending us all the agreements, I think. Not that I've read them, because I haven't. I'm not sure if anybody has.
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm disappointed to hear you haven't read them all, but I can tell you that it's a bit of a burden. We don't mind sharing the interagency agreements if that's what the legislature wants. It is a bit of a burden to send you 5 or 6 emails because your email inbox is only limited to such a size, and so we have to send multiple emails to you. If we have a lot to send you, we could maybe start just giving you a thumb drive with the interagency agreements on them. I know that there was a bill last year that was actually in conference committee when you all adjourned that would have deleted the language that said and copies of the agreement from the requirement. So I'm not sure what the status of that bill is right now. But.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. I mean, maybe... if there was a link to a website someplace where we could just find them, and probably, I don't think there's anything, if you're sending them to me, they're public. Mm-hmm. I know that, because there's nothing that you can send to legislators that isn't public. And so I suppose other people might want to see them, maybe if they have insomnia. And so, maybe you could figure out a way to just put them on a website somewhere and send us one link. And do it that way rather than cluttering up the inbox because I don't think I'm the only legislator who gets tons and tons and tons of email. Mm-hmm. And, I also am sensitive to the fact that our people like you and that are working in your departments have plenty to do. And so I know you don't mind giving us the information. That's great, but I would rather that it be, if I feel a need to find it, that I just go somewhere to find it rather than having it filling my inbox mm-hmm. like that.
Thanks, Representative Liebling. And I think when you look at some of the agreements and the dollar amounts and the scope of work that have been moved from one agency to another, was particularly if you look at the line on 9, Minsure DHS, $11.763 million. We've appropriated a lot of money within the agencies to do the work, and then they're billing each other for much of that work. We've also had a gigantic influx of minute bills from one agency to another, and that's kind of grown and new in our time here. And as you know, our data systems and IT rollout has not been stellar and actually requires more accountability and not less from the administration and as far as legislative oversight. So I think that it's something that we should all pay closer attention to. And as the administration looks to, as any administration would look to vendorizing appropriations from one to another, I think we have to reassert our oversight over those dollars, and particularly when they're not doing a good job. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for being here and for providing us the quarterly reports. And however you do it, if you do it by link or a thumb drive or in this way, I appreciate the transparency that you're offering us. It is easy, I think, sometimes to look at a few data points and draw a conclusion or lift up maybe some suspicion about what's actually happening. And so that you are offering not only all of the reports, but the legal authority by which you're doing your work, the amount of money that's being spent, I think is a way for us as the legislature to oversee what you're doing and to understand that you're doing it within your proper authority. And I think underneath these questions is the, you know, sort of the root of this is, are the agencies working within their authority? Are you doing what you are being asked of in statute and law? And as I have looked at these reports and have listened to you, I think that you are telling us that you are. I like that you raised the question, not that you know of, is there been a time where you have worked outside of that? And if there's a better way for you to get information to prove that that hasn't happened, which is always hard to do, I think that would be useful for me and for the committee. But I think what we're doing here, what we're looking at, even though it is tedious, is a measure of transparency. And for those who may be worried by listening to this line of questioning that agencies are working out of their authority, you are with your work showing us that that is not the case, and I appreciate that.
All right. Other questions for the testifiers? All right. Seeing that, thank you for your presentation today. And with that, we are adjourned.